Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
New data from the Government Accountability Office estimates agencies lost as much as $521 billion in programmatic fraud between 2018 and 2022. The Office of Management and Budget strongly disagrees with that estimate. It questions the plausibility of GAO's assessment. No matter what the real amount of fraud is across the government, and agencies may never know for sure, the Treasury Department is giving agencies some tools to stop fraud before it starts. For more about how the agencies can use these tools, Federal News Network's Jason Miller spoke with the Fiscal Assistant Secretary at the Treasury Department, David Liebrich.
Oftentimes, it was very difficult to raise our hand in real time and say, we can get money out the door and prevent fraud at the same time. We have something called the Center of Payment Integrity, in which we have a number of databases that we allow agencies to match against. And that includes looking at things like eligibility verification, making sure we're not paying dead people, for example, understanding whether the vendor has problems and we shouldn't be doing business with the vendor, whether there's been someone incarcerated, and other kind of eligibility criteria, the data that we can provide. In addition, we're also offering a service called account verification services, in which we can make sure that when a payment goes to a bank account, it is in fact going to a real bank account holder. And so we can do that in real time. And third, we've had some success with really looking at check fraud and how we can minimize check fraud, which is a problem that's it's impacting, you know, in the private sector and in the banking world is a really big problem. And the government, while we have done a lot to try to make sure that most of our payments, in fact, close to 98% of our payments are electronic, that last 2% that are checks, we want to make sure that we have a lot of protection and prevention around those checks. So we've recently implemented a tool which uses machine learning to actually look for anomalies on those 40 million checks that we issue. And if we see an anomaly, that we actually flag that check and let the financial institution know that there's a potential problem with it. And to date, that tool has stopped over $500 million of fraudulent payments that have gone out, that would have gone out otherwise. Very good collaboration with the IG community with that tool and allowing us to then use it to actually bring more cases against fraudsters. But we have a lot more opportunity to do even more of that kind of thing.
That's a great news story, David, that I think sometimes doesn't get told enough. And you and I have talked about this over the years, that there's always a lot of really interesting and important efforts going on that maybe don't get enough sunlight. So I appreciate you bringing the sunlight. Maybe talk a little bit more about that tool without getting into the deep dive of the technology. You mentioned machine learning, looking for anomalies, and I know there may be some sensitivities built in, but generally, how does it work? Does it check against what, or give me a sense of the how?
So like in the case of much of machine learning, when you're looking at large data sets, what it allows you to do is to, with great deal of speed, to look at where there are anomalies. And so as those checks are going through and they're scanning the checks, they're seeing if something looks unusual. Those models get refined as time goes on to say the false positive gets removed. And so that you have more and more confidence that when you actually identify a problem with that check, that you have confidence that it really has a problem with it. And so this is another case which I would say is that we, the government, have limited capability to design quickly new technology and skills that the private sector is actually investing a lot of money in. And so this is another example where we have leveraged the private sector, and we will continue to level the private sector in terms of looking at really their tools, the tools that are being used that we might be able to take advantage of.
Now, was this started as a pilot and you're expanding it? Where are you at with this? Because you mentioned you recently implemented the tool. Is it being used on a limited number of accounts, meaning payments that are going out? You mentioned about 40 million in checks, or is it going across all checks that are going out across all parts of the government? Give me a little more details.
Yeah. So you always start when you introduce new technology into an environment, you do want to test to make sure it's right. And as I mentioned to you before, you test with, especially with things like machine learning, is you have to bring a lot of data in, and you want to make sure that you're running a lot of data through to make sure that you eliminate the false positives and you fine tune the tool. We are now using it full out on all checks that are being presented to through the Federal Reserve to the Treasury, and that information that is going back to financial institutions in really near real time, so that the financial institution can take quick action. We are also going to be holding an industry day shortly. You mentioned, what other opportunities there are, in which we have asked the private sector to come in and tell us what kinds of tools they're using, to explore with them about which of those tools may be appealing to us or have potential applicability in our environment.
And this industry day is more than just checks, because as you said, about 98% of all money going out the door is electronic. So it's a problem, but not the biggest problem. This is really looking at data and tools to stop fraud, to reduce improper payments, I would imagine.
Exactly. And I would also put it in the same category, while it's not artificial intelligence or machine learning. I mentioned the account verification system, in which we're actually, when we issue a check, we're bouncing it to make sure that the account is legitimate and that the payment should go there. And as a result, when we did the economic impact payments and also the child tax credit payments, we were able to virtually eliminate fraud in the electronic payment realm because we were actually making sure it was a legitimate account. And we did two things with economic impact payments, which I think is very important. We started using the account verification tool, as well as started to say, if we were going to make an economic impact payment to an individual who already was receiving a government payment, and we were comfortable that that was a legitimate account, we flipped some of those payments to go directly to those accounts. And so that ability to do that significantly reduced fraud, but also importantly, it made for a much better end user experience. You know, it was safer, faster, and more secure actually to have that payment go electronically than it would have been to send a check, in which you may have had a problem of someone either intercepting a check or alternatively altering the check and creating a bigger problem.
The other thing I want to just go back to real quick is the account verification piece. Now, are these tools like account verification, like some of the do not pay lists, some of the other things, is that open for anybody to use? Meaning, is a fee for service, or if it is, it's something that most agencies can pay for? Give me a sense of who can use the tools and how do they get to that point?
Treasury in many ways plays a central role in many things like issuance of payments and collecting of money and financing the government. And so these are services that are free to agencies, and we want to encourage agencies to actually use these databases and to run their payments against those databases. Now, in the end, the agency has to make a determination about whether they want that payment to go through or not. With so many payments that we issue, we don't have the ability to make judgments ourselves at Treasury. Only the agency can make a judgment about whether it's a payment that they'd like to make or not make, because they're the ones who provide us the amount and the person who's actually going to receive the payment. And so one of the challenges I think that we face is, how do we make sure that agencies have the capability to use our services? And then once they get the information back from us, what do they do with that information? And in some cases, you know, there are situations where a hit will occur, and in fact, it should be a payment. It's legitimate. And there are other cases where it really should be a flag. And I think as we look into the future and trying to really develop these capabilities, we should be scoring every payment that the government makes. So we should be putting some sort of confidence level around that payment. And I think in the future, with some of the tools that are out there, we should be able to do that. And you then can refine that scoring as you go along. You get more confidence. And so really, in many cases, like, for example, in a natural disaster, when you make a payment, that's a moment where there's a high potential for fraud. And so in that particular case, if you're sending a payment to a new bank account, you might have more of a concern about whether that is, in fact, a appropriate payment. If, on the other hand, during a natural disaster, you're sending that payment to someone who's been receiving Social Security for the last 10 years, you have a high confidence that that payment is probably going to the right person, that there's not fraud attached. And so I think as we get more sophisticated and our tools grow, we should be able to give agencies a better sense of exactly, you know, where does that payment fall in that spectrum. And I would also mention one other thing along these lines. What we've seen in the private sector as we've gone out and spoken is, you get more confidence around these scores the better you are at aggregating different data sources. And so things like, is it a new bank account? Is it a foreign address, an international address? You know, there's kinds of things where you're trying to pull information that sort of gives you a better confidence about the integrity of that payment.
Dave LeBrick, the Fiscal Assistant Secretary at the Treasury Department, speaking with Federal News Network's Jason Miller. Check out Jason's story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, What do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.